This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Just a few weeks ago, I talked on the show with Mike Spies. Mike is a reporter for The Trace, a website that covers guns and the gun industry, and he contributes to the New Yorker as well. One of the things that Mike talked about was the precarious financial state of the NRA. He said that pensions there had been frozen. And one detail that really surprised me, Mike said that the NRA had stopped providing free coffee in the office, which is never a good sign for any business. Over the years, we've come to think of the NRA as practically omnipotent in Washington and in many state capitals as well. But the problems, financial and legal, run very deep. Here's Mike Spies.
So back in March, last month, Wayne LaPierre, the NRA's top official, sent out a fundraising letter to his members. And it was what I would describe as an urgent plea for money. And what he was telling them specifically was, we're facing an attack that's unprecedented, not just in the history of the NRA, but in the entire history of our country. The Second Amendment cannot survive without the NRA, and the NRA cannot survive without your help right now. Wayne LaPierre is right. The NRA is troubled. In 2017, the organization had to borrow millions of dollars from its foundation, from its officers' life insurance policies, and it also liquidated several million more dollars from an investment fund. I wanted to find out the root cause of why the NRA is convulsing. One of the people I spoke with was Aaron Davis. Davis started at the NRA in 2005 and worked for a decade in the organization's fundraising department. He grew up with the NRA, reading its magazines as a boy. And for him, working at the organization was a kind of dream.
Part of the allure of working at the NRA was you could feel the power. You were intimidated by the power, but you respected it. You looked up to it. And we felt that the folks we were working for were top-notch and didn't even think about what did they make. Now, of course, you'd heard, oh, I think this person makes $400,000 a year. And you're like, what? That doesn't make sense. But when you're in your meetings, you're thinking, oh my gosh, this person is going to change America. We're going to be the best organization there ever was on the face of the planet. And so whatever they cost, that's what they cost.
The key to the NRA's problems is what it does with money. I've been searching through tons of documents, federal tax forms, charity records, contracts, corporate filings, and internal communications. And it seems a small group of NRA executives, contractors, and vendors have extracted hundreds of millions of dollars from the nonprofit's budget, enriching themselves in the process. Central to this story is a for-profit public relations firm called Ackerman McQueen.
So Ackerman McQueen was a very professional for-profit organization, a marketing firm, if you will, that had been doing a lot of projects around NRA. They weren't NRA members by any stretch.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they were just paid to be part of a marketing firm. So they're your typical, like, New York, Austin types, but they weren't your folks who were interested in Second Amendment politics.
For more than three decades, Ackerman has shaped the NRA's public identity, helping to build it from a niche activist organization into a ubiquitous presence in American culture. Ackerman has produced and devised the NRA's most successful and divisive ad campaigns. In fact, when you're hearing from the NRA, most of the time you're really hearing from Ackerman McQueen.
We stop this. The only way we save our country and our freedom is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
The NRA and Ackerman have become so intertwined that it's often difficult to tell where one ends and the other begins. In Aaron's fundraising department, they were going after big money donors with highly produced marketing materials that cost a lot of money to make. In 2008, Aaron's boss was a guy named Ben Case, who had been at the organization for several years.
Ben hired what I still perceive to be the guru, and I'm not going to say his name, but the guru of major guest fundraising in all of the nation. He hires him to come in and give us a day-long training to raise more money. And you know, we say, we're having trouble. We're not raising like what we think. And so he holds up one of our marketing materials that Ackerman had produced. And he goes, this actually will hurt you from raising big money. Donors don't want to see that you're spending so much money when they give a large gift. The best types of fundraising materials are black and white with a couple of, you know, color photos. And there was an argument right there between some of our, especially one of our directors and this fundraising guru saying, no, that's not true. And so it was, that always had that in my mind, like, well, if this is more effective, why are we doing it this way?
2 years after this seminar, Ben Case was removed from his position, and a former Ackerman McQueen executive, Tyler Schrupp, was installed in his place. Tyler, unlike Ben, had limited fundraising experience, and as soon as he took over, most of the fundraising team's outside business was sent to Ackerman McQueen.
They were so close to us. They were always in our offices. Their account executive was always in our offices, and he was doing projects with us, and our budget was increasing. We were doing more of that sort of thing. But in my 10 years of fundraising there, I saw that fundraising at NRA was very difficult. We had, I'd say at least 80% of our fundraisers didn't raise as much as they cost.
Wow.
It was not an easy place to raise big dollars for.
After Tyler came in, do you have a sense overall of how much of the total expenses being generated by the advancement team were ultimately being steered into Ackerman McQueen's coffers?
I don't. That was kept under wraps.
It was kind of, yeah.
I only saw my budget, but overall, I did not know where all the money went. So, and it just rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I kind of want to make that point that this is not something that, oh, Aaron feels like something's being done wrong. It was the entire department, from what I could tell, felt the same way. We all felt that there was too much of this, like, insider baseball type thing. It was not, it did not seem above the bar. And we felt bad about it. A lot of us felt bad about it.
Which is interesting, right? Because you would think that those expenses would have to be justified in some sense. There'd have to be some clear return on the big investment.
Absolutely. And a lot of board members kind of knew that.
In 2017, the NRA paid Ackerman McQueen and its affiliates almost $41 million. That number accounted for 12% of the organization's total expenses that year. So you've got a company that is sucking up a huge amount of the NRA's budget and is also exerting an incredible amount of control over the organization.
They're a for-profit organization trying to make money, trying to do things that would bring more money to them. So they have completely different intentions than a nonprofit should have, which is for the common good, for the better good. And so those lines were just so blurry. But as you read and you learn the laws and you see what the IRS is writing, you get to this kind of push and pull. It even made me question anything I was saying in donor meetings when I was pushing gifts. Is this okay? Can I have this meeting with this congressperson? Is that okay? Am I supposed to be even doing an event with Rob Portman? I don't know.
Right, right. There's almost like an inherent conflict of interest.
I think so. I think there is an inherent conflict of interest. It just doesn't seem, and I think one of the reasons I'm willing to come forward is it just doesn't seem like NRA leadership is all that concerned about this.
The Ackerman relationship is just one example of a host of opaque, sketchy arrangements that the NRA leadership has forged over a number of years. It goes beyond just the NRA's inflammatory rhetoric. It's a systemic problem that infects the entire organization. I actually got copies of internal handwritten memos. They were created by Emily Cummins, who until November was the NRA's managing director of tax and risk management. So I'm looking at one of the pages now, and you can see that Emily has flagged a list of top concerns. The memos assert that the NRA pays overbilled, deceptive, vague invoices to preferred vendors and contractors. Staff is told to process payments without documentation. And the memos also say, and this is perhaps maybe the worst thing, that the board hasn't been told of what's embarrassing. And that's the part that rubs up against nonprofit law. If a business arrangement poses an obvious conflict of interest, the board has a responsibility to not only know about the arrangement, but it also has to provide a reasonable justification for okaying it. And if they don't, then that's a major red flag. And the NRA, as it turns out, has a number of red flags. Now, nonprofit law is fairly murky, so I spoke with the former head of the IRS's nonprofit division. And he told me that if these red flags are in fact violations of the law, that the New York Attorney General could take a number of actions. The Attorney General could sanction board members or disband the board or go to court and ultimately argue that the organization is so far gone that it could be disbanded entirely.
Developing right now, the National Rifle Association is suing one of its longtime ad partners.
We're talking about Ackerman McQueen Advertising Agency.
In a surprising twist, the NRA has now turned on its longtime collaborator. Earlier this month, the NRA filed a lawsuit against Ackerman McQueen over concerns about Ackerman's activities and accounting practices, suggesting that the NRA doesn't actually know the details of its most significant business arrangement.
Conflict of interest, but we will see what the court does next. In the newsroom, Grant Herms, Oklahoma's Own News 9.
And yet all this financial stuff doesn't completely explain why Aaron Davis, who had been so proud to work for the NRA, is taking the rare step of blowing the whistle. Aaron, like many of his co-workers, believed wholeheartedly in the mission of the NRA. But the NRA, as a big institution, doesn't welcome dissent. People who have spoken out have been marginalized or even shunned. So for Aaron, the best way forward in the end was just to quit.
In a way, Mike, it kind of feels like you're drinking the Kool-Aid. And while some of what NRA says is right, I mean, it is an American organization that loves America. I don't know if they love Americans. I don't know if they love people that don't look like them, because it's all about politics and winning. And that especially came to a head at Sandy Hook after that happened. And in the offices, I was sitting in the office, and we actually had the lights out in the office. We weren't allowed to send emails. That period of time between when the shooting happened to when Wayne LaPierre actually spoke, which I think was like 7 or 9 days, we weren't even allowed to really do work, but we still had to come into the office. And we were scared. The staff was scared we were going to lose our jobs, that NRA is over. And the message that came from Wayne, we didn't hear until he came on TV.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Would you rather have your 911 call bring a good guy with a gun?
And after the television interview, which I thought didn't go well, it wasn't empathetic at all, everyone in the office was just like, oh my gosh, we won. And I don't know how you win something like that. I don't know how, and you know, everyone felt better after that. And except for maybe there was my manager at the time, she was scared for her children's life.
Right.
That was like the extent of it. But it's like, let's move on. We won that battle, that political battle. Let's go on.
Right.
And it just, that's not okay. I mean, that's not who we are as humans.
Right.
We have to be more cognizant. You know, you can have a belief in the Second Amendment and you could believe that it's a individual right and Supreme Court, this and that. But you have to care about people that are citizens of this country. I just feel like there's a sickness of the heart within NRA leadership.
That's Aaron Davis speaking with reporter Mike Spies. Davis worked for the NRA from 2005 to 2015. You can find Mike Spies' reporting on the NRA at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. And thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.